Imagine this scene. You're working at the local emergency department in a small Midwest town, and a 24-year-old man is brought in by ambulance. His girlfriend accompanies him, and she tells you that she found him unconscious on the couch and called paramedics, who treated him with naloxone at the scene. He is now awake, but still a bit drowsy. He confides in you that 2 years ago, he injured his back doing construction work, was prescribed oxycodone for back pain, which he became hooked on. He developed cravings and increased tolerance to oxycodone, needing to take more pills each time to chase a euphoric high. He recently progressed to heroin, lost his job, and has experienced strain in his relationship with his girlfriend. While opioids are commonly prescribed to treat pain, you consider how this class of drugs can lead to addiction and the disproportionate impact such drugs have had on your patient's life. How do opioids work? What makes them such high risk for addiction? And what are the treatments and withdrawal care you can provide for your patient? And welcome to Audio Bricks. I'm Yoon Weitzholz, here to bring psychiatry from our bricks to your ears. After today's episode, you will be able to 1. Describe the etiology and epidemiology of opioid use disorders. 2. List the most commonly used opioids in the United States and their associated potency, delivery method, and physiologic effects. 3. Describe the DSM-5 diagnostic features and criteria for opioid use disorders, as well as the clinical effects of opioids. And 4. Describe the evidence-based assessments and treatment approaches for opioid use disorders. Part 1. What are opioid use disorders? Opioids are a class of drugs with many medicinal uses, including for analgesia or pain relief and cough suppression, as adjuncts to general anesthesia, and as antidiarrheal medications. Opioids describe drugs like morphine and codeine that are found naturally in the opium poppy plant. Synthetic drugs like fentanyl and methadone that target the same receptors but are not found in the opium poppy are referred to as opioids. Opioids that are created by chemically modifying a naturally occurring opiate are referred to as semi-synthetic opioids. These include some of the most commonly used opioids, such as hydrocodone and oxycodone, which is modified from thebaine, and even heroin, modified from morphine. Before we dive into the meat of our audio brick, let's test what you just learned. What is the difference between opioids and opiates? The answer is that opiates like morphine and codeine are naturally found in the opium poppy plant. Opioids like fentanyl and methadone are synthetic drugs. Okay, those are the two key terms I want you to keep in mind for today's episode. Opioid use disorders can be classified into opioid dependence or opioid withdrawal. Opioid use disorders that are not treated can cause many social and personal problems, ranging from a lack of personal hygiene to homelessness, along with domestic disputes, poverty, and increased rates of crime. Let's talk about some of the features of opioid addiction and then learn about diagnostic criteria and treatment for opioid use disorders. Part 2. How common are opioid use disorders? As you may have heard in the news, opioid use disorders are a growing, alarming problem in the United States, particularly in Midwest states. An estimated 2 million people in the United States have opioid use disorders. According to the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, almost 1 million people reported using heroin in the United States in 2016. Roughly 170,000 people reported using heroin for the first time. This trend seems to be driven largely by those aged 18 to 25 years. Statistically, young white men are more likely to abuse opioids. Those who suffer from chronic pain, specifically back pain, are also at a greater risk of having an opioid use disorder. Mood and psychological problems and psychosocial stressors can predispose people to opioid dependence. Additional risk factors for opioid abuse include younger age, history of mood disorders, access to opioid prescriptions, and a greater degree of subjective pain. Let's stop here to see if you are paying attention. treatment of which medical condition puts patients at risk of developing opioid use disorder. Patients with chronic pain, especially back pain, may become dependent on opioids after taking them to treat pain. Part 3. What causes opioid use disorders? Substance use disorders occur due to addiction. An addiction in general occurs when the desired substance becomes irresistible and cravings for it are heightened. Addiction, opioid abuse, and overdose can occur in anyone using opioids because of the highly addictive potential of this class of drugs. How do opioids function in the body? Well, to better understand the pharmacology of opioids, we need to learn about how these drugs act at the molecular level. So here we go. Opioids bind to opioid receptors in many organs to exert a range of physiological effects. And where are these receptors located? Well, many of these receptors are located in the brain, spinal cord, and gastrointestinal tract. Opioid modulation of pain is due to binding of opioid receptors in the central nervous system. There are three major classes of opioid receptors: mu, delta, and kappa. The primary effects of opioids, including euphoria, are mediated through the mu opioid receptors, and morphine is a prototypical mu receptor agonist. Quick review of this key point. Through which receptors do opioids act to exert their euphoric effects? The answer is mu opioid receptors. And did you know the human brain actually produces endogenous opioids? It does! Our brains produce and release endogenous opioids in the form of endorphins to modulate pain. For now, let's focus in on mu receptors, since they are the target proteins involved in addiction. How do opioids work to reduce pain? Opioids have two sites of action, the presynaptic nerve terminal and the postsynaptic neuron. Opioid receptors are G-protein-coupled receptors. Opioids have their major effect in the central nervous system by acting presynaptically by inhibiting neurotransmitter release. And there are three ways that opioids can reduce neurotransmitter release. First, opioids inhibit presynaptic calcium channels, which inhibits neurotransmitter release. Second, opioids increase opening of voltage-gated potassium channels, which prolongs the hyperpolarization period of neurons, preventing synapses from firing too soon. And third, opioid receptors, once activated, inhibit adenylate cyclase, which inhibits neurotransmitter release. And how do all these mechanisms lead to reduced pain? Well, the decrease in neurotransmission is what leads to reduced nociceptive or pain impulse transmission. Let's do a pop quiz before continuing. What are the three synaptic mechanisms by which opioids function to reduce neurotransmitter release? Opioid receptors, once activated, inhibits presynaptic calcium channels, opens potassium channels, and inhibits adenylate cyclase. Now we understand how opioids work on a physiologic level. But how do these drugs produce that euphoric feeling that can lead to addiction? The answer lies in how opioids interact with other neurotransmitters in the brain. Opioids interact with the inhibitory neurotransmitter, GABA-aminobutyric acid, or GABA. GABA inhibits and thereby limits the release of dopamine in the nucleus accumbens. Remember that dopamine is a neurotransmitter associated with feelings of reward. Opioids can act by inhibiting GABA, leading to increased dopamine release and potentiating the feelings of reward and then the euphoric effects. What are the clinical effects of opioid use? Well, short-term effects of opioids include euphoria, constricted pupils, analgesia, dizziness and fainting, vomiting, difficulty urinating, and constipation. Long-term effects include depression, respiratory distress, and possible fatal overdose. For people who inject opioids intravenously, additional long-term effects may include collapsed veins and skin infections, increased risk of hepatitis, HIV, and infectious endocarditis. Acute complications of opioid overdose include fatal overdose and respiratory depression and arrest. Here is a question you'll encounter over and over again, so let's make sure you can nail it. What are the clinical acute effects of opioids? Acute effects include euphoria, constricted pupils, dizziness and fainting, vomiting, difficulty urinating, and constipation. Part 4. What are the most commonly used opioids? The United States is facing an opioid epidemic. Increased numbers of deaths in opioid users that may continue to rise if there are no interventions. Common clinical uses for opioid medications include acute or chronic pain, cough suppression, diarrhea, acute pulmonary edema, and maintenance therapy programs for recurring heroin addicts. Opioids can be delivered to a person's system in many different ways. The most common ones are oral consumption, inhalation, and IV injections. IV administration consists of the drug being directly injected into the bloodstream, bypassing liver metabolism and accelerating its effects. One of the most commonly used opioids is morphine, and it is typically administered intravenously. Fentanyl is a more potent and synthetic opioid that can also be given intravenously and through a transdermal patch. Fentanyl is known to be 100 times more potent than morphine, which is why it is more commonly associated with fatal overdoses. Pop quiz on what you just learned. What are two most commonly used opioids? Morphine and fentanyl. Part 5. How are opioid use disorders diagnosed? The classic presentation of acute intoxication from opioids includes pinpoint pupils, euphoria and analgesia, drowsiness or coma, impairment in attention or memory, and slurred speech. But where do you begin in diagnosis? Well, to diagnose a patient with an opioid use disorder, you have to return to medical basics. Begin by performing a thorough history and physical exam. Refer to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 5th edition, or DSM-5, which has a set of criteria for diagnosing each of the opioid use disorders. Today, we'll focus on the diagnostic criteria for opioid use and withdrawal disorders. Note that a patient who has an opioid use disorder can become addicted over time to the point that they are physically dependent on the opioid. When a person is physically dependent and suddenly ceases using the opioid, the individual will be in a state of withdrawal. Let's now walk through in detail the diagnostic criteria for opioid use disorder and withdrawal. How is opioid use disorder defined? Well, opioid use disorder is defined in the DSM-5 as when a person exhibits two or more of the following criteria within a 12-month period. Three of the criteria are the usual signs of addiction we associate with substance dependence: cravings, or a strong desire or urge to use the substance; tolerance, or requiring progressively more opioid to achieve the same effects; and withdrawal, or experiencing symptoms which are only relieved by taking more opioid. Five of the criteria revolve around the psychological lack of control over opioid use. These include often taking larger amounts or using the substance for a longer time than intended, a persistent desire or unsuccessful attempt to cut down or control substance use, spending a lot of time obtaining, using, or recovering for substance use, recurrent use of the substance in situations where it is physically hazardous, or continuing to use the substance despite knowing that a persistent physical or psychological problem is probably caused or made worse by the opioid. Finally, three of the criteria revolve around the negative social and life impact of opioid use. These are failing to meet important obligations at work, school, or home because of recurrent substance abuse, continuing to use the substance despite recurrent social or interpersonal problems caused or made worse by its use, in giving up or reducing important social, occupational, or recreational activities because of opioid use. Now that we went through the criteria for opioid use, what are the signs and symptoms of withdrawal? Well, withdrawal effects are essentially the opposite of the acute opioid agonist effects. A diagnosis of opioid withdrawal is defined as a person experiencing three or more of the following within minutes to several days after reducing or stopping opioid use, or after administration of an opioid antagonist after opioid use. Such symptoms include dysphoric mood, nausea and vomiting, muscle aches, pupillary dilation, sweating, diarrhea, and insomnia. Quick question to test your knowledge. What are common symptoms of opioid withdrawal? Dysphoric mood, muscle aches, pupillary dilation, sweating, diarrhea, and insomnia. Now, opioid withdrawal can be extremely distressing to the patient, but it is rarely life-threatening. On the other hand, opioid overdose is rapidly lethal if the patient does not get prompt medical attention. The reason these overdoses are rapidly lethal is that they cause uncontrolled respiratory depression. Even when the respiratory drive is not depressed to a lethal extent, episodes of non-lethal hypoxia can lead to hypoxic brain damage of variable severity. Something else to keep in mind is the importance of suicide risk. This risk is similar to that for other substance use disorders, with a heightened risk for both attempts and completed suicides. Repeated opioid intoxication or withdrawal may be associated with severe depression that, although temporary, can be intense enough to lead to suicidal attempts. Part 6. How are opioid use disorders assessed and treated? As a clinician, you'll play a vital role in the identification of an intervention for opioid use disorders. When it comes to talking to a patient, it can be difficult knowing how to frame these questions. So how should you approach the discussion? Below are some ways they can be phrased when talking to a patient about the use of opioids. For instance, you can ask, "Have you had times when you ended up using opioids more or longer than you intended?" Or, "Have you experienced cravings, a strong need or urge to use opioids?" You should also ask about the impact of their opioid use on their social and family relationships. "Have you found that opioids often interfere with taking care of your home or family, or cause trouble at your job or at school? Or, have you continued to use opioids even though it was causing problems with your friends and family?" With your exam, be sure to assess for infections related to opioid use. In people who use IV drugs, infectious endocarditis commonly affects the right-sided heart valves, as opposed to the left-sided valves in non-IV drug users. Users of IV drugs also have an increased risk of chronic infections, such as HIV and hepatitis C. For these reasons, it is vital to obtain a thorough history, understand the extent of the patient's drug use, and determine their route of administration. If there is uncertainty about whether the patient has used opioids, a drug screen can provide evidence of recent drug use. In the United States, a drug screening is mandatory for pregnant women who are suspected of having an opioid use disorder. Now, pop quiz before we move on. What additional assessments should you make in patients with opioid use? Assess patients for infections like endocarditis, HIV, and hepatitis C. Once you confirm that a patient has an opioid use disorder, what are the treatment options? Well, treatments depend on their situation. For treating opioid use disorders, methadone and buprenorphine are typically first-line options. Methadone, like heroin and morphine, is a full agonist at mu opioid receptors. Methadone also has a longer half-life, which allows it to satisfy opioid cravings without the accompanying euphoric effects. However, an overdose of methadone can still cause fatal respiratory depression, and for this reason, it must only be administered under supervision by a health practitioner at the methadone clinic. Another medical option is buprenorphine, which functions only as a partial agonist at mu opioid receptors. With chronic use, the risk of respiratory depression is minimal, and after a brief supervised administration period, it may be prescribed and taken at home by the patient. Let's test your knowledge of treatment options. What are the two first-line options for treating opioid use disorders? The answer is methadone and buprenorphine. For opioid withdrawal symptoms, there are a number of medications that can be used in addition to methadone and buprenorphine. One option is lofexidine, which is an alpha-2 adrenergic receptor agonist. It is historically used to treat high blood pressure, but has been approved for use in the United States for treating opioid withdrawal symptoms. Clonidine, another alpha adrenergic receptor agonist, which helps patients who abruptly stop long-term use of opioids, can also be used. This drug helps patients with sympathetic nervous system effects of withdrawal, like tachycardia, hypertension, and restlessness. Naltrexone is an opioid antagonist that should be given after the completion of opioid withdrawal. Naltrexone blocks the effects of opioids and is used to prevent relapse. It can be administered via intramuscular injection or orally. Pregnant women who are dependent on opioids should be given maintenance therapy with buprenorphine or methadone. It will help to prevent neonatal abstinence syndrome, in which a newborn experiences withdrawal symptoms shortly after birth. In addition to pharmacologic interventions, there are counseling options for opioid use disorders, as well as Narcotics Anonymous and other effective support groups. Moral support for continued abstinence is also helpful. For adolescents, family and behavioral therapy interventions can be especially beneficial. Follow-up for opioid use disorders should include routine testing for liver and kidney function, as well as infections. Okay, one final question. Why do we give maintenance therapy to pregnant women dependent on opioids? The answer is to prevent neonatal abstinence syndrome, where the newborn experiences withdrawal symptoms after birth. And that's it for opioid use disorders. Let's see if we've completed the goals of our episode. First, can you identify the key demographics and risk factors of patients for developing opioid use disorder? The rate of opioid abuse in the United States is rapidly increasing and is largest in those aged 18 to 25 years and in young Caucasian males. Risk factors include younger age, history of mood disorders, and access to opioid prescriptions. Second, can you describe how opioids work in the body and how its pharmacologic effects can lead to addiction? Opioids bind opioid receptors in the nervous and gastrointestinal systems. Opioids act by stopping pain transmission by inhibiting presynaptic calcium channels, opening potassium channels, and decreasing adenylate cyclase activity. All these effects lead to decreased neurotransmission and reduced pain transmission. Opioids also increase dopamine release, which potentiates feelings of reward and accounts for the euphoric feelings. Next, can you describe the clinical effects of opioid intoxication? Short-term effects include euphoria, constricted pupils, analgesia, dizziness and fainting, vomiting, difficulty urinating, and constipation. Long-term effects include depression, respiratory distress, and possible fatal overdose. Now, can you describe the DSM-5 diagnostic criteria for opioid use disorder in general terms? Opioid use disorder is defined by persistent opioid use that interferes with daily functioning. The DSM-5 criteria is the same as that for substance use disorders and requires at least two of the characteristic features over 12 months. I won't repeat all the criteria again, but remember that the three intuitive features are cravings, tolerance, and withdrawal, along with psychological lack of control in using and stopping opioids. Next, how would you treat opioid use disorder? Methadone and buprenorphine are first-line options. Counseling options and support groups are also helpful. Naltrexone is an opioid antagonist given after completion of opioid withdrawal to help prevent relapse. pregnant women should be given maintenance therapy to prevent neonatal abstinence syndrome. Finally, for opioid withdrawal, what are the symptoms and treatment? Opioid withdrawal symptoms include dysphoric mood, nausea and vomiting, muscle aches, pupillary dilation, sweating, diarrhea, and insomnia. Withdrawal can be extremely distressing, so keep in mind the importance of suicide risk and evaluation. In addition to methadone and buprenorphine, alpha-adrenergic receptor agonists like lofexidine and clonidine may also be used to treat sympathetic nervous system withdrawal symptoms like tachycardia and high blood pressure. Now, with our newfound knowledge of opioid use, pharmacology, and treatment, let's revisit our patient from the beginning of the episode. If you recall, a 24-year-old man is brought into the emergency room for heroin overdose and is now awake after being given naloxone. He originally became hooked on oxycodone pills prescribed to him for back pain. What questions will you ask your patient to assess his risk for opioid use disorder? What additional exams and tests would you order? And what treatment and withdrawal support would you recommend to your patient? You ask your patient about getting uncomfortable cravings for opioids, and he tells you, "I've tried to quit, but I can't do it on my own. What can I do? If I don't shoot up, I get so sick." When it comes to the amount of drug use, he says that initially he had to take increasing numbers of oxycodone pills to achieve the same euphoric sensation and then progress to heroin. When he tries to stop, he breaks out in sweats, gets extremely restless, and has abdominal aches. Given the negative impact on his relationships and job, you conclude that he meets multiple criteria for opioid use disorder. To help him take action towards quitting, you begin by counseling him on what to expect on withdrawal symptoms. You give him an initial prescription for buprenorphine and coordinate with the hospital social worker to help him enter a treatment program. Together with his girlfriend, you also explain how and why naloxone is used in case of another overdose. Before the patient is discharged, you remember to further assess him for infections related to opioid use. His blood work and blood culture returns negative for infectious endocarditis, HIV, and hepatitis C. Finally, you ask your patient about symptoms of depression and suicide risk and conclude that he does not have depression or is at risk of suicide. You explain to him that the journey to quitting and recovery will have ups and downs and that it won't be perfect, but you've given him a lot to think about at a critical time with supportive programs to help his recovery. And that's our show for today. Make sure to like and subscribe. Your feedback continuously helps us to improve. You can get the full RxBricks experience online at www.usmle-rx.com, complete with illustrations, study questions, flashcards, and active learning. Happy studying, and until next time, talk to you later.